All but one of them gave their lives for the cause. Beheaded, crucified, and one, according to tradition, was crucified upside down. Amongst them, they contributed 21 books to what became the most published, most purchased, most read literary work in all of human history, the Bible. They were the foundation of a spiritual movement that forever changed the world. In 300 years, they grew from what was a little offshoot of Judaism to become the most dominant ideological and spiritual force on the face of the planet. Today, more people profess to strive to live according to the teachings and writings recorded by these men than any other faith. We know them simply as the apostles or the 12 disciples. And yet there could have been no more unlikely cast of characters. They were an oddly diverse assortment of personalities and backgrounds. Right? They were fishermen, gruff, uneducated, blue-collar workers. One was a tax collector, a hated collaborator with Rome, regarded by his fellow Jews as a traitor and a thief. One was a zealot, a political revolutionary, actively working for the forceful military overthrow of Roman rule. One of them was a Pharisee, a religious perfectionist and a self-righteous cultural elitist. Others of them are almost completely unknown. We know nothing of their lives before Jesus called them, and we know almost nothing of their lives after. And yet, he chose them to help establish the church. And without that, history, the church, it would not be the way we know it. They changed the course of history. Nobody would have chosen these guys, right? They didn't have the right education. They didn't have the right background. They didn't have the right experience. And they certainly didn't have a proven track record. Their resumes were all wrong. Let's look at it from a modern point of view. Let's say that Jesus was beginning his earthly ministry now, and he hired a consulting firm to help him as he chose his people to help lead him in his new endeavor. And so Jesus receives this email back about his selection to Jesus, son of Joseph, woodcraft carpenter shop, Nazareth, from Jordan Management Consultants, Jerusalem. Thank you for submitting the resumes of the 12 men you have picked for management positions in your new organization. All of them now have taken our battery of tests. We have not only run our results through our thorough computer analysis, but we've also arranged for personal interviews for each one of them with our psychologist and vocational aptitude specialist. It is our professional opinion that most of your nominees are lacking in the background, education, and vocational aptitude for the type of enterprise you are undertaking. Simon Peter is unstable. He makes impulsive decisions, is outspoken and braggadocious. The two brothers, James and John, the sons of Zebedee, are given to fits of temper and are prone to place personal interests above company loyalty. Thomas demonstrates a questioning attitude that would tend to undermine company morale. We also believe it is our duty to inform you that Matthew has been blacklisted by the Jerusalem Better Business Bureau. And James, the son of Alphaeus, and Simon the Zealot in particular, have radical political and paramilitary leanings. Both registered a high score on the manic depressive scale. One of your candidates, however, shows great potential. He is a man of ability and resourcefulness. He meets people well, has a keen business mind, and contacts in high places. He is highly motivated, ambitious, and responsible. We recommend Judas Iscariot as your controller and right-hand man. All of the other profiles are self-explanatory. We wish you every success in your new endeavor. Well, that's the human way of looking at things. Nobody would have picked these guys. Well, nobody, that is, except for Jesus. But Jesus sees things in people that no one else sees. Jesus, who finds potential where no one else sees anything but failure. Jesus, who believes in what you can become without holding what you are against you. Jesus, who does the extraordinary with the ordinary. He's the one. He's the one who picked them. He's also the one who picked you. Now, Jesus took these egocentric, self-serving, unqualified men, and he transformed them into sold out, world-changing servants. Now, we want to explore this unlikely cast of characters. And as we do that, it won't show us what only God could do with them, but it will also be a comfort and maybe a challenging reminder of what God can do with us. So let's begin our discovery this morning with the life of Andrew. Now, let me get you a feel for Andrew. Andrew always had to play second fiddle to his big brother, Peter. He had to grow up in Peter's shadow, right? Just imagine he had to always hear how Peter was doing in school and how Peter performed on the football team. And he always got Peter's hand-me-downs. Everything he had is what Peter used to have. Some of you grew up in the shadow of your big brother or big sister, or maybe it was the shadow of your parents who loomed large over your life. Right? Others of us, maybe it wasn't somebody's shadow, but we just know we're not going to be the ones to throw the fourth quarter touchdown bomb. Right? We're never going to be making multi-million dollar deals. Right? We're never going to have hundreds of thousands of followers on Instagram. Right? The truth is, most of us will never be a celebrity. We'll never be carried off off the field on our team's shoulders. Right? No writer's ever going to write a rave review of our work. No crowd will yell for our encore. And despite what Andy Warhol said, we will never be famous, not even for 15 minutes. But have you ever watched the end credits of a blockbuster movie? That long list of names that goes on and on. Right? And have you ever read what they do? Right? What's a key grip anyway? You see, a movie isn't successful only for the dozen or so stars that appear on the screen, but there are hundreds and hundreds, even thousands of people working behind the scenes that make a movie successful, right? But you never notice them, you never see them, but without them, no movie would ever get made, no album would ever get recorded, no concert would be performed, no team could win a championship. All right, it always takes people who are willing to play second fiddle. And without second fiddle players, nothing could be done. Well, Andrew was one of these second fiddle players. Andrew was not the star. Right? He would never have appeared on anyone's list of who's who in anything. And other than when Jesus called him and a couple of other incidental references, Andrew takes center stage in the pages of the New Testament, like only in three occasions. But what's interesting about these three appearances is that in each one of them, Andrew is bringing someone to Jesus. Now, Andrew's not known for any great thing that he said. He's not known for any great things that he did. All Andrew did was bring people to Jesus. Now, sometimes the people he brought to Jesus did great things. But Andrew, he was never the one that got the spotlight. He never got the credit. He never got the leading role. He played second fiddle. But without second fiddle, Jesus would not have been able to conduct the beautiful symphony that he did. So let's look at the first of these moments. Andrew was the big brother of Peter, all right? They grew up in the town of Bethsaida. Bethsaida was a large Gentile city. It was built by King Herod on the northern shores of Galilee. And it was from there in Bethsaida that Peter and Andrew had their fishing business. Well, Andrew was a follower of John the Baptist, right? Andrew was there when Jesus was baptized by John the Baptist. He was there when John said the things about Jesus that he said, all right? And so he knows that John believes that Jesus is the Messiah, and he knows that he believes in John, and so that means he believed in Jesus. All right, and this is where we pick up the story in John chapter 1, verses 40 through 42. Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, was one of the two who had heard what John had said and who had followed Jesus. Right, the first thing Andrew did was to find his brother Simon and tell him, "We have found the Messiah, that is the Christ," and he brought him to Jesus. Andrew's conversion to Jesus was so intense that he was convinced that Jesus was the Messiah, and he wanted everyone to know. He wanted his brother to know that Jesus was the Messiah as well. Now, of course, we all know that Peter would go on to be a part of Jesus' inner circle, that he would become the leader of the apostles after Jesus ascends into heaven. It was his sermon that was preached at Pentecost that was the first sermon in the history of the church that leads to 3,000 people being baptized into Christ. And he would become the most influential leader in the early church. And then there's Andrew. And Andrew, well, he's the one that brought Peter to Jesus. Right? But without Andrew, there's no Peter. And there's no indication that Andrew was ever jealous of his brother. There's no hint that he ever felt slighted. Now, in a similar situation, we might have considered ourselves snubbed. I know I would, all right? After all, Andrew could have said, "I was one of the first two disciples. I was one of the first ones who believed that Jesus was the Messiah. I'm the one who brought Peter to Jesus. Why shouldn't I be included in the inner circle?" And yet from all the evidence that we have, Andrew was content to play second fiddle. All that mattered to him was that he was a follower of Jesus and that he could play his part and play it well, however small that part might be. I think we also see here in Andrew a bit of God's definition of success. Right, you see, success in God's eyes isn't what we achieve and accomplish for ourselves necessarily, but it's what we enable others to achieve and accomplish. And that's what Andrew did for Peter. Andrew put his brother Peter in a position where he could become all that God wanted him to be. And he gave him the freedom to do that once he got there. Right? Andrew could have been like an annoying little brother in the background. "Why don't you let me? How come you get to do all that?" He didn't try to manage or manipulate Peter to satisfy his own wants. And there's something here that every church needs to learn, and that is that true successful ministry only happens when we're willing to put others in a position where they can become all that Jesus wants them to be. Right? We focus way too much on me, myself, and I. We focus on our own needs, our own wants, our own gifts, our own ministry, and it hinders the church all over the place because we want to see ministry get done our way. But when we are willing to let others thrive, when we're willing to let others get the credit, when we're willing to let others get the glory and give them the room they need and not worry about you know, who gets the credit, then ministry can flourish. And after all, shouldn't God be the one that gets the glory? That's just the first time Andrew brings somebody to Peter. The second time, we find out that it's not just leading apostles that Andrew brings to Jesus, but later on in John chapter 6, verses 5 through 9, we read this scene. When Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming toward him, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?" He asked this only to test him, for he already had in mind what he was going to do. Philip answered him, 8 months' wages would not buy enough bread for each one to have a bite. Another of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up. "Here is a boy with 5 small barley loaves and 2 small fish, but how far will they go among so many?" It's a story that many of us know well. If you grew up in the church or you went to a lot of Sunday school, you know the story of the feeding of the 5,000. Even if you're a brand new Christian or not a Christian at all, this story is so familiar in our culture. We've heard references to it. But all day long, the crowds have been following Jesus. They've been listening to Jesus, right? But they haven't had a thing to eat. And the day is getting long. The sun is growing low in the western sky. And here they are. There's too many of them. They're too far out of town. But Jesus knows they need to be fed physically as well as spiritually. But it isn't just the crowds that need spiritual food. So do the disciples. And so Jesus uses this occasion as a teaching moment to provide some spiritual nourishment for the 12. And he asks a probing question, and he asks it directly of Philip, but obviously at least Andrew heard it as well. And I think he asked this question to see if they're really paying attention. Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat? Now, Jesus already knows. He already has a plan. But what about the disciples? Now, this should not have been a trick question. They've already seen amazing miracles, and they know that Jesus is not just Lord of the spiritual realm, but he's Lord of the natural world as well. I mean, they have seen Jesus change ordinary water into extraordinary wine. They have seen him heal an official's son with just a word. They've seen a lame man walk away with his mat rolled up, tucked underneath his arm after just one short encounter with Jesus. They've seen all of this, so they should know by now. But do they have faith enough? Are they beginning to understand? Now, Philip, he doesn't get it, all right? He is still thinking in purely earthly terms. And he does the calculations. 8 months' wages wouldn't be enough to give even every person just one bite. But there's Andrew, and he's over here, and he's listening to this go on. And, well, he doesn't fully get it either. But here's the key. What little Andrew does have, he brings to Jesus. Right? It maybe wasn't quite the answer that Jesus is looking for, but it's something to work with. Andrew says, "Here is a boy, 5 loaves, 2 fish." It wasn't much, but it was all he had, and he gave it to Jesus. He brings the boy to Jesus, and that's what counts. I also want to point out here, did you notice how Andrew is referred to in John? Simon Peter's brother. All right, he's already living in Peter's shadow here. He's not just Andrew. He's Andrew, you know, Peter's brother. He's already been upstaged by his sibling. But it doesn't seem to bother Andrew at all to play second fiddle. Once again, Andrew plays only a small part, but then Jesus does great things with it. How about you? Will you give God what you have, even if it's just a little? Are you willing to let Jesus do great things even with your small part? Because you see, in Jesus' eyes, there are no small parts. Second fiddle is just as important. Second part does not mean second rate. We read about a third time that Andrew brings some people to Jesus. It's in John chapter 12, verses 20 through 22. And here's what it says. Now, there were some Greeks among those who went up to worship at the feast. They came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee, with a request. Sir, they said, we would like to see Jesus. Philip went to tell Andrew, and Andrew and Philip in turn told Jesus. So again, we see kind of Philip and Andrew side by side here. Now, we don't know anything about these Greeks. We don't know what they wanted. We don't know what the conversation was about. We don't know what came of this meeting with Jesus. But what we do know is this: they were Greeks. It means they were Gentiles. Now, they were going to the temple to worship, it says. Now, maybe this means they were what was known as God-fearers, non-Jews, Gentiles, but they believed in God. Or maybe they were, you know, merchants out of town who were working in Jerusalem or the area, and they just wanted to go and pay their respects to the local gods. That would not have been an unusual thing to do. If you were a traveling merchant and you were in a city doing business, you would go to the local temple. You would make offerings to the local gods because obviously you want their blessings on your business. We don't know where these Greeks fell into that spectrum, but somewhere along the way, they've heard about Jesus and they want to know more. But here's the thing. What we do know is that there were people who wanted to see Jesus. And so what does Andrew do? He takes them to see Jesus. Now, you and I, we live in a world full of people who need to see Jesus. The question is, who's going to take them? Will it be you? Perhaps God wants you to be the Andrew in their lives. You see, Andrew could have handled this situation totally different because these people weren't Jews. They were Gentiles. And Jesus was a Jewish Messiah. And Andrew could have looked at his role as, wait a minute, I need to keep these people away from Jesus. I need to protect Jesus from these people. And you're going to come across people in your life that you're going to think, these people don't deserve Jesus. They're not worthy. These aren't the kind of people we want in church. And you'll discount them. You'll put up little barriers to keep them away. But that's not what Andrew does. It doesn't seem to matter who it is. He brings people to Jesus and then let Jesus worry about the rest. And that's our job. It doesn't matter who it is, bring them to Jesus and let Jesus take care of the rest. But we can learn a lot from Andrew, right? Because I think most of us have to play second fiddle, at least in some part of our lives. Maybe it's at home and our role in the family. Maybe it's at work. Maybe it's at church. We all have to play second fiddle. We have a supporting role. Most of us aren't the boss at work. We're not the leader of a big ministry. And we need to learn, like Andrew, to accept our roles both graciously and gratefully. In a musical composition, second violin is of equal importance to first violin. You see, a musical score is composed for all of the instruments in an orchestra. And if you take out second violin, well, then the composition is diminished, right? The harmony suffers. Now, I've shared this quote before, but it is so perfect here. But the great composer Leonard Bernstein was once asked, what is the most difficult instrument to play? And he quickly replied, second fiddle. Right? I can get all the first violinists I need, but to find a competent and skilled second violinist who plays with enthusiasm, that's the problem. And you know, all of this sounds familiar, like I've heard this somewhere before. And then I think of the words of Paul. The body is a unit, though it is made up of many parts, and though all of its parts are many, they form one body, so it is with Christ. The eye cannot say to the hand, I don't need you. God has combined the members of the body and has given greater honor to the parts that lacked it, so that there should be no divisions in the body, but that its parts should have equal concern one for the other. If one part suffers, then every part suffers with it. If one part is honored, then every part rejoices with it. Now you are a part of the body of Christ, and each one of you is a part of it. Let me conclude with the story of Al and Frank. And for you old school Monday Night Football fans, I'm not talking about Al Michaels and Frank Gifford. Al and Frank were best friends, and they both wanted to study to be artists, but Al and Frank were also both very poor. And so they decided that one of them would work while the other studied art, and when he completed his studies, they would then swap places. And they drew lots, and it was decided that Al would study art full-time while Frank supported them working. And so after several years, Al finished his studies and became an acclaimed artist. And he returned to exchange places with his friend, Frank, but when he arrived, he discovered what a great sacrifice Frank had made to help him complete his studies. Frank had worked at such hard manual labor that his sensitive fingers and delicate hands that could produce such beautiful artwork had been so gnarled, they became permanently crippled. It was no longer possible for him to become an artist. But there was no bitterness in Frank's heart. His happiness was in the joy of knowing that he had made Al's career as an artist possible. And then one day, Al saw Frank kneeling in prayer, and his rough and gnarled hands were clasped together, and Al began to sketch those rough, chiseled hands. And out of that original sketch came what became what is now Albrecht Dürer's most enduring and famous work, a painting simply entitled Praying Hands. You've seen it before. You know it well. And though Franz Nigstein never became an artist, it was his haggard hands that made Albrecht Dürer's career possible. And his hands became the centerpiece in one of the most famous works in art history. And so, Franz, we salute you. Andrew, we salute you. To all of those in the church that graciously and gratefully play second fiddle, we salute you. We need more people like Franz. We need more Andrews. We need you. Thank you, and God bless.